Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, researchers say they've cured type 1 diabetes in mice, but will it work in humans?
And a different ending to a famous pollution case. The culprit wasn't the company the jury said it was, but that doesn't change the victim's pain.
It still hurts to think that these companies did what they did and that our sons are no longer here.
Also, John Hinckley says he's fit to be a free man.
He plays his guitar. He does some reading, and his pastime is feeding the stray cats that prowl the grounds of St. Elizabeth's Hospital.
These stories and a review of Master and Commander.
Coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Jurors in the trial of accused Washington, D.C. area sniper John Elad Mohammed are entering the final hour of today's deliberations. NPR's Brian Naylor has more from Virginia Beach.
The panel of seven women and five men began their deliberations a little after 9 Eastern time this morning. They're weighing 4 charges against Mohammed, 2 of them capital murder charges for the killing of 54-year-old Dean Myers at a suburban Virginia gas station in October last year. Jurors have 3 weeks of testimony to sift through and a number of pieces of physical evidence to review, including the Bushmaster rifle prosecutors say fired the shot that killed Myers. In closing arguments yesterday, prosecutors portrayed Mohammed as the captain of the killing team that included his alleged accomplice, Lee Boyd Malvo, whose nearby trial resumes Monday. Mohammed's lawyers say prosecutors are relying on speculation, suspicion, and innuendo in the absence of proof. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
A 40-hour Republican-led talkathon in the U.S. Senate has ended, but despite all the talking, Republicans failed to muster the 60 votes they needed to end a Democratic filibuster blocking votes on some of President Bush's judicial nominees.
On this vote, the ayes are 53, the nays are 42. 3/5 of the senators duly chosen and sworn not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
Presiding officer of the Senate, Rhode Island Republican Lincoln Chafee, announcing that Republicans had come up 7 votes short. One of the biggest fires in Chicago in years ripped through a warehouse section of the Windy City before dawn today. Tony Sarabia of Chicago Public Radio has details.
The fire in the 4-story brick building was reported shortly after 3 a.m. Fire Department spokeswoman Molly Sullivan says shifting winds made it difficult for firefighters to get the blaze under control. She says the fire sent flames and billowing smoke high into the sky as firefighters used a curtain of water to try to prevent embers from blowing into nearby homes. Sullivan says some of the homes were evacuated as a precaution. The fire in the initial warehouse died out because the building collapsed, but the blaze then spread to at least 3 other buildings. One firefighter called the fire the largest in a decade in terms of the number of people and the amount of equipment called to the scene. For NPR News, I'm Tony Sarabia in Chicago.
A U.S. Apache helicopter attack has killed 7 people near Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. The U.S. says they were planning to attack a U.S. base. Meanwhile, American forces launched more strikes on insurgents in Iraq as they continued what is being called Operation Iron Hammer. Stocks are mixed at this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 7 points to 98.44 in moderate trade. The Nasdaq's down 11 to 19.55, and the S&P 500 is down a fraction. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, jurors are in the second day of deliberations in the state of Alabama's lawsuit against Texas oil giant ExxonMobil. The state accuses the company of cheating on its royalty payments for natural gas wells drilled in state-owned waters along the Alabama coast. The state's attorneys have asked the jury to return a $9.3 billion verdict. The government reported today that its main wholesale inflation gauge, the producer price index, rose 0.8% last month. That was mostly due to higher food and auto prices. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The rise in the government's producer price index, a measure of the cost of goods before they head down the pipeline to consumers, was the biggest in 7 months. Along with higher prices for cars and light trucks last month, the government says wholesale food prices were up, led by an 18% rise in beef prices, the biggest one-month jump in nearly 30 years. Prices for fuel oil also moved higher, heading into the prime winter heating season. Stripping out volatile food and energy, however, the rise in wholesale inflation wasn't quite so dramatic. The so-called core rate rose 0.5%. But even so, the report showed slightly more inflationary pressure than many analysts had expected. The data is likely to be picked apart by economists. That's because signs inflation's heating up could prompt the Federal Reserve Board to consider raising interest rates, though most indications are the Fed still plans to hold the line on any increase in rates for some time. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Federal Reserve reports that industrial production rose in October by 0.2%. That was only about half as much as economists had been predicting. In September, industrial production rose 0.5%. I'm Ann Roselle, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders, more than books, music, and movies, a meeting place for original thinkers and original ideas. Location information at BordersStores.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Iraq is both reborn as a country and a place where violence and death still stalk the future and threaten to ruin it. Anthony Cordesman's just returned from 2 weeks in Iraq. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And Mr. Cordesman, is there any image that sticks in your mind when you think about what you just saw in particular?
Well, on the one hand, there are two images. One is riding back in a C-130 with an American soldier who had given his life. That brings home the reality that other men's sons and daughters are basically defending us and making the sacrifices. And that may be easy to forget. Sometimes we think in terms of numbers and grand strategy and not the people who are actually paying the cost.
Mm-hmm.
But the other image, frankly, is in many areas of Iraq, the schools are operating. Normal life is returned, and we are not talking about a national conflict, but a highly localized one in general, in areas which were in the past strongly supporting Saddam Hussein and which benefited from him in ways which they can never hope to do in the future under a more democratic government.
Mr. Cordesman, what do you make of the a new approach, seemingly, from the U.S. military in Iraq, bringing in bigger firepower, F-16 jets, AC-130 gunships, attacking a warehouse that turned out to be empty in Baghdad, seemingly to make a point to the enemy there. What about the raising the ante approach that they're getting into now?
Well, a lot of these missions are in response to specific tactical threats where you don't want to go in on the ground and confront Iraqi forces. They disguise the fact that forces are putting much more emphasis on civic action programs, on aid, not just on bullets. But the reality is this is a serious conflict. The enemy can raise the ante, not just us, if we use longer-range systems. They're making better use of rockets and mortars, more sophisticated use of explosive devices. And this is not a conflict that in any sense is over or where we can say we're decisively winning.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's on a tour of Asia. He said on that tour that he thought that we wouldn't see any kind of democratic elections in Iraq for at least 2 years. Is your sense that it could be much longer than that and that democratic elections would have to compete with a guerrilla war that's ongoing many years down the road?
I think the message from virtually all of the military is that right now we have the tolerance of the Iraqis. If we try to hold on without elections, if we try to rely on the current governing council, if we don't have a constitution, we're going to lose the battle for hearts and minds. The same is true of a great deal of the aid mission. If we are not really prepared to go on with the aid mission in almost the context of armed nation building, again, we lose hearts and minds. And the same will be true if we continue to rely on the governing council and on exiles and leaders which do not have a popular following in Iraq, and we provide no basis for Iraqi leaders supported by Iraqis to emerge.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Mr. Cordesman.
Thank you.
There might finally be a use for the spleen. In a surprise discovery at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, cells from the human spleen were found to be a potential cure for type 1 diabetes. Doctors at MGH have already cured type 1 diabetes in mice by injecting them with spleen cells, which seem to regenerate the damaged pancreas, enabling it to produce insulin. Dr. Denise Faustman is lead author of the study, which is published in today's issue of Science. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, this is quite a day for you, I know. And here's first the question on everyone's mind. Does this mean this is a cure for human diabetes?
Well, of course, we don't know the answer to that question, but that's our next goal, to try to translate these findings from spontaneously diabetic mice to people who have the disease.
I know that this is a multi-step process, but if you could simplify it for us, tell us a little bit about how it works when you actually inject these cells from the spleen into the mouse. How does it help the pancreas regenerate?
Well, it turns out that the spleen appears to have two different types of cells. One cell is the white blood cell, which has long been recognized to be in the spleen, but there also appears to be pancreatic precursor cells in the spleen that know exactly where to go in these diabetic animals, and they go to the pancreas and regenerate the insulin-secreting cells.
It completely regenerates so that the pancreas is now producing insulin.
That's right, with good blood sugar control.
And is this just in mice who may have recent onset diabetes, or is this a mouse, for instance, that's had long-term diabetes? Does it completely reverse the symptoms?
Yes, we're using, this is an important question, late-stage diabetic animals. So this is not an animal that is pre-diabetic with not elevated blood sugars. These animals are fairly much end-stage animals that are rescued.
And remind us, I mean, when the pancreas isn't working and it isn't producing the insulin, what happens?
Well, that's diabetes. And in the case of type 1 diabetes, the islet cells that secrete insulin are destroyed by the white blood cells. So if you don't have islets, you don't have insulin. And if you don't have insulin, you have high blood sugars. And that's bad.
Over time, you can it damages the heart, the kidneys, eyesight.
Yeah.
And people have to inject themselves with insulin to monitor it themselves. And this is very different from sort of lifestyle-induced diabetes?
Yes. Remember, there's two types of diabetes in two general categories. There's type 1 diabetes, used to be called juvenile onset diabetes or childhood diabetes. In that case, the white blood cells kill the insulin-secreting cells. And then there's type 2 diabetes, which is a problem usually with obesity and lots of insulin early on in the disease, and there's not enough insulin to go around for the body mass.
I want to talk a little bit about your research. I hear you were having trouble getting funding until you bumped into Lee Iacocca about 8 years ago. He's, of course, the auto executive. His wife died of diabetes. How important was his infusing your project with some funds?
Oh, it's extraordinarily important. He wanted to support projects that had very novel ideas, and he came to the forefront, similar to his industrial career, saying, I want the high-benefit projects that are unproven.
Mm-hmm. And now you're looking for money to further the trials with humans.
Yes, and when I say we are looking for money, it's the greater we of the diabetes unit at the Mass General.
Yeah, and that is not inexpensive.
No. Humans are always more expensive than animal experiments. But on the other hand, making a change in the care of people who have an extraordinarily devastating disease is a cheap alternative.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Faustman, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Denise Faustman, immunology lab director at Massachusetts General Hospital. She co-authored the new study on diabetes and a possible cure, published in today's issue of the journal Science.
New scientific evidence seems to cast doubt on who the bad guys really were in the 1999 movie A Civil Action, which featured John Travolta. The film portrays a suburban town's brave, underdog legal struggle against W.R. Grace Corporation, and how in 1986, a federal court declared W.R. Grace had polluted the water supply of Woburn, Massachusetts, where there had been a rash of deaths from leukemia among children.
If the jury decides favorably on the geological evidence, then you could bring your families in.
Your Honor, otherwise, the jury came into this courtroom expecting a human drama.
I don't
and instead,
care what
they
for
were 3 months, we've been giving them lessons in geology.
But was the villain of A Civil Action, W.R. Grace, really guilty? WBUR's Alan Cockle has been following startling new developments in the story, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, Bill.
So, Alan, new scientific evidence, a new study. How did they conduct the study? What does the evidence show?
Well, after the trial, there were eventually found to be in Woburn 5 polluted properties. The new study is a computer model. It takes the chemicals on the properties and it models how they move, how the water, the rainwater, and the groundwater moves through the land and how the chemicals move with them. And what it seems to show, and I talked to Scott Baer from Ohio State University, one of the scientists who did the study, what it seems to show is that Beatrice, the company that wasn't found guilty, in fact did contribute to the pollution. W.R. Grace, the company that was found guilty, probably didn't contribute very much.
In some of the plausible scenarios, the TCE plume from W.R. Grace reaches well H, but it doesn't get there till late 1974, early 1975, and the wells were shut down in May of 79. And the concentrations that get there from the Grace Unifirst plume are much lower than the concentrations that get to well G from other sources. And then there are other scenarios where the plume from W.R. Grace and Unifirst doesn't get to well H before they're shut down.
What does this mean legally?
Legally, it doesn't mean anything. The case is closed. There's an EPA Superfund cleanup ongoing. So it doesn't mean anything legally, but it does have a couple of interesting implications. One is that there's a new computer model that can be used for other cases, future cases in other towns. The other thing is that this model may be useful to the EPA to decide how long to continue the cleanup and whether to expand it. And interestingly enough, this computer model of how the pollutants move is linked to another computer model of how water was distributed through Woburn. So by doing that, the scientists can actually make an almost a house-to-house, month-by-month estimate of how much chemicals got to each house. And that may be very useful to medical researchers who can finally sit down and look at exactly the link between the cancers and the exposure to chemicals.
What could possibly be more emotional than children coming down with leukemia, possibly because of pollution? Reaction from Woburn from parents of children?
Well, sure, and none of the companies involved had much reaction to this. As you might imagine, they would like to leave this in the past and get on with life. But I talked to a couple of the mothers who lost sons to leukemia. One of them, Donna Robbins, says to her what really matters is not which companies polluted those wells, but the fact that all of them dumped chemicals.
This is about people. It's about kids. And I don't want people to have to focus on W.R. Grace or Beatrice on this study. It's a different degree of chemicals that they all dumped. Some of them got there much quicker, much more concentrated, but they all contaminated. And it still hurts to think that these companies did what they did and that our sons are no longer here.
She mentions Beatrice Foods, which was also brought into the original federal court decision. Now, was that federal court decision, Alan, clear on whether there was a link between the pollution and the leukemia, or only that they had indeed contaminated the water?
The way the case was structured, the jury never got a chance to examine the link between pollution and leukemia, so there was never a legal decision on that. It was settled. The only decision that the jury ever made was that Beatrice wasn't found guilty, and W.R. Grace was found guilty of contaminating those wells.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
WBUR's Alan Cockle.
Just ahead, should John Hinckley, the man who shot Ronald Reagan, be freed? Hinckley says yes, some legal experts agree, and he has a hearing next week.
And later in the show, Prince Charles and the stories that are not fit to print in Britain.
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
They say he looks the same, still a little pudgy, soft-looking, still blonde. But is he still crazy? John Hinckley, the man who shot President Reagan and three others 21 years ago, is 48 now. Then he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Now he's appealing to be released from St. Elizabeth Psychiatric Hospital in Washington on the grounds that his mental illness is in remission. Hearings on the state of Hinckley's sanity begin Monday. Michael Sokolov has researched John Hinckley for this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, and Michael joins us now from Bethesda, Maryland. Hello, Michael.
Hello, nice to be with you.
Well, first of all, remind us, set the context for this hearing. It's certainly not the first appeal.
No, it's not the first appeal. John Hinckley has filed various appeals over the last decade, really. But I think there's the sense that this time he's been said to be well for quite a while. There's a new judge, and this is seen as a possible turning point, this hearing coming up.
His psychiatrist and lawyer are saying that his psychosis is in remission, but he saw a psychiatrist, as you write, just before he shot the president. And at that time, the psychiatrist said, you know, he was pampered. That was his problem.
Well, first of all, this is all in the realm of guesswork to some extent. There's no blood test to be given, but the psychiatrist that he saw back in Colorado 2 decades ago essentially misdiagnosed him. He said that he was a pampered young man from a rich family, and all he needed to do is go out and get himself a job. Well, that was really wrong. I mean, John Hinckley was a seriously sick, psychotic young man, and once he saw the team of doctors that he's seen at St. Elizabeth's, and even before then, that was discovered, basically.
So I guess, but a lot of people would say, well, if he was wrong, these current psychiatrists could be wrong, too.
Well, they could be. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what the government will say. The government essentially argues that John Hinckley is unknowable, that he's deceptive, and therefore continues to be dangerous. One thing that's significant to know is that the government has hired expert witnesses, its own psychiatrists, and they have come in with reports that agree with Hinckley's psychiatrist, that he's in remission, that he's no longer a danger to himself or others.
Mm. You weren't able to interview John Hinckley himself. He and his family are not giving any interviews, but you paint quite a picture of where he is now in his life. Could you tell us a little bit about what you found out about him?
Well, he lives in a relatively small room, 10 by 15. He plays his guitar. He does some reading. And he wanders the grounds of St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which is this famous mental health institution where the poet Ezra Pound was for almost a decade. And now it's this big, empty, eerie place. Mm. And John Hinckley wanders the grounds, and his pastime is feeding the stray cats that prowl these grounds.
He had been dating, as you wrote, another patient at the hospital, a young woman who shot and killed her own daughter and was considered cured of her illness and was released. And he's trailed constantly by Secret Service agents?
Yes, he is. I mean, the Secret Service is, for obvious reasons, quite interested in people who even threaten to shoot the president. Well, John Hinckley has taken a shot at the president, wounded the president. So when John Hinckley has outings off the grounds to go bowling or to go to the beach or shopping with other patients in a hospital van. They follow this van. They follow him everywhere he goes. Sometimes they look through the gates at St. Elizabeth's or come on the grounds and follow him there and observe him.
As you write, they presumably will continue to follow him. Do you think that will be entered in the hearing as evidence that, well, he'll be watched if he's released?
I don't know if it will be talked about at the hearing, but it's certainly an important subtext, because the judge in this case, who will be ruling on whether Hinckley should have a conditional release and ultimately whether he should be given greater freedoms, this judge will know that, number one, he's making a very unpopular decision if he gives John Hinckley his freedom. But he'll also know that there's sort of this security blanket that the Secret Service is going to be tailing him in a way that other released mental patients certainly aren't tailed. I mean, he's in a separate category all his own, certainly more notorious, but in one way safer, because the Secret Service is going to keep their eye on him.
Yeah. You mentioned conditional release. It's sort of a trial period where he'll have unsupervised visits with his parents, and then people will see how it goes. But, you know, this is a fellow who... Yes, he tried to kill the president. He also stalked actress Jodie Foster. He had an attraction to Nazism, an affinity for Charles Manson. He wrote letters to Ted Bundy. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think should happen? Am I right in feeling that you have sort of an opinion on it?
Well, I have two opinions on it, I think that that my opinion probably matches the opinion of people who feel themselves to be compassionate people. On the one hand, he's a patient undergoing therapy. He is not a criminal in the eyes of the law being punished. So the compassionate side of me says he needs to have his freedom. But I have this other part of me that says, you know what, he shot the president. And if you shoot the president, you probably are never going to see the light of day. It's a very difficult issue, because you feel one thing in your heart and another thing in your head. And I will add that the most compassionate, most liberal people I know, I have yet to find one who seems real comfortable with John Hinckley being out on the street. It's a natural way to feel. You take a shot at the president, tough luck. But he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and not guilty are two very powerful words in our system of law.
Right. And public opinion should not influence legality.
Absolutely not. That's not to say that it won't, but it certainly should not. And the momentum is very much toward his freedom, unless... the judge steps in the way.
And we have to also remember, before shooting President Reagan, he stalked President Carter.
He stalked President Carter. He talked of shooting various other people. You know, he was a pretty creepy figure in our history. And one of the hurdles that has to be gotten over is to see that someone can possibly change. And this is a whole different equation than if he had been convicted criminally. He was not convicted criminally. So all of these negative feelings that we legitimately have towards someone who committed this terrible act, who talked about committing other acts, they don't apply, or they don't apply under the law.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Michael Sokolov's article in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine is entitled, Should John Hinckley Go Free?
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, thousands of men are attempting to stave off the effects of aging with testosterone.
This looks like a potential possibility, given the fact that some preliminary anecdotal evidence suggests that this particular drug might do the very things that men are having concern about.
And we review the new manly drama, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
England is under threat of invasion. And though we be on the far side of the world, this ship is our home. This ship is England.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. Two U.S. soldiers are dead and three others are wounded following a roadside explosion in Iraq. A military statement says the attack occurred yesterday about 75 miles north of Baghdad and struck a U.S. convoy. An American civilian was killed in a separate incident. Tomorrow, U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer will meet with Iraq's governing council to present Washington's ideas on a faster transfer of power from the U.S. to Iraq. It's now up to the jury in the case of suspected D.C. sniper John Muhammad. The Virginia Beach jury is deliberating his fate this afternoon. If convicted, the case will then shift to a sentencing phase. Jurors would then decide whether or not to impose the death penalty. At least eight people have died in windstorms that have swept across the Midwest and East since Wednesday, including three motorists hit by falling trees. Electricity is out for around 380,000 homes and businesses, including 94,000 in Pennsylvania. Wind gusts of up to 50 miles per hour remain in the forecast for today. Winds are expected to abate by sundown. The pilot of an ill-fated Staten Island ferry is now out of the hospital. Richard Smith had been hospitalized following the October 15th crash that left 10 people dead. A federal prosecutor is now probing the accident. A marathon Senate debate on judicial nominations has failed to change any minds. James Limbach reports.
After almost 40 hours of debate, senators voted on ending the filibusters against the nominations of three of President Bush's appeals court nominees. And three times, presiding officer Lincoln Chafee read the same result.
On this vote, the ayes are 53, the nays are 42. Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
60 votes are needed to invoke cloture and bring on a final confirmation vote. The president entered the fray on Thursday, bringing Judges Priscilla Owen, Carolyn Kuhn, and Janice Rogers Brown to the White House, demanding that senators who he said are acting shamefully give his nominees an up or down vote. James Limbach, Washington.
The first congressional overhaul of national energy policy in a decade calls for billions of dollars in tax breaks for energy industries. The energy bill agreement between House and Senate Republicans also gives a boost to farm states because it doubles the use of corn-based ethanol as a gasoline additive. Given the Republican majority on Capitol Hill, final legislative approval is expected next week. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up 7 points at 98.44. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Now, when it comes to fictional intrigue in Great Britain, we all know the butler usually did it. But in real-life Britain, you can't broadcast or print that Prince Charles allegedly did do it with his butler. British libel laws prevent newspapers, radio, and television from spelling out just what Prince Charles did or didn't do with his former valet. Censorship, plain and simple, say some. But is censorship really even possible anymore? A question we're putting before our editorial roundtable today. Joining us on the line are Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
And Tom Maroney, columnist for the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom.
Hello, everybody.
Well, Tom, under court order, no newspaper in Britain published details of allegations that Prince Charles had a sexual liaison with an aide. But the allegations were detailed in Scotland, in Australia, in Europe, and all over the world, all over the Internet. Tom, is censorship of this sort of gossip even possible anymore?
Well, I think you've really answered the question in the question. I mean, we have such a global database, if you will. It's really hard to keep anything from anyone. And it shows the power of the Internet. So I would say no. I don't think it's possible. We have these laws in Great Britain, and as we see, they're really not of much use.
And yet many newspapers imposed a gag order on themselves, including the New York Times, which took the story about all this off its website after it had appeared there for 20 minutes. NPR couldn't say what the allegations were because the network is heard in Britain. Maybe, on the other hand, there's an argument for not putting everything out there all the time.
Well, I suppose, and I think that that's, one of these good taste decisions that have to be made.
Oh, yeah, that good taste.
The good taste. I will say, though, that there's a pattern here that I take umbrage with, if you will, to use perhaps a word the royals are using today. The mafia launders money in much the same way the mainstream press today launders muck. And what I mean by that, we saw it somewhere in the Lewinsky scandal with President Clinton, too. The yellow sheets, the tabloids, they went ahead and they printed some of these sordid details with unnamed sources. And then the New York Times comes along, other prestigious media outlets, and they report on the fuss that's going on about the tabloid reports. Mm-hmm. So on today's New York Times website, we have an AP story that talks about it was all good news for Prince Charles yesterday because for the first time in nearly 2 weeks, he wasn't mentioned in any of the rags over there. And I love this line. It says the public's media-fed fascination. So at once, the Times is slipping the story into their pages, if you will, kind of in a sneaky way. And they're also doing it in a condescending way. Like, look at that. The public, the unwashed, are getting all excited about these reports and these lesser publications. I find it hypocritical and slightly irritating.
But, Pat, it has become news, hasn't it? And let's face it, we love muck. Even the New York Times now has, you may have noticed, just in the past month or so, a gossip column.
Sure. It's all about what people are talking about and the clamor by all media to latch on to what people are talking about. And I agree. It's a matter of taste and a matter of a lot of different rules. It just seems like there are no rules anymore. And I'm going to underscore the good taste element in the clamor to get the dirt on people and the information because we think that's what people want to read. We've lost that element of good taste.
Well, I would say, Pat, that I'm not against gossip. I'm the first one to enjoy a good nugget of gossip. I would only say that as these more prestigious outlets and more well-known brands, if you will, take on the role of a gossip or include this in its product, that they be upfront about it and they not be ashamed of it.
I agree.
Acknowledge that you're getting your fingernails dirty a little bit and have some fun and leave it at that.
Well, here's another media event to turn our attention back to this side of the pond, Pat. That media event, the 30-hour ongoing debate Republican senators held this week to protest Democratic foot-dragging on the president's judicial nominations, not to belittle the problem over judicial nominations, but they were inviting in conservative radio talk show hosts to exploit the situation.
It's one of the few talkathons that seem to be able to raise no money or come to no conclusion. I'm also kind of wondering if all that hot air in Washington isn't responsible for fueling the winds that are whipping through the rest of the
North. Did it get the issue out to people?
I don't think so. If they're looking for the public's attention, they're not getting it.
I think, Pat, you're exactly right. I think that for the small percentage of people paying attention, these are political junkies. These are people that are going to pay attention anyway. And I think that for those who do take a peek at what's going on there, it's one more example of why a lot of America is turned off by the political process.
Yep.
Couple of local stories just to finish up. Tom, what was making headlines in your neck of the woods this week?
Well, we had a report on a house that exploded. I'm not sure if you have these in your neck of the woods, Pat, but this is natural gas. Sometimes these buildings aren't up to code. This was a terrible story for our paper to cover because two little girls perished in the explosion. This was late at night. I lived so close to this house that I heard the noise. I thought it was an oncoming thunderstorm. As it turns out, the utility company is being blamed in this report for some code violations and some things that weren't up to snuff. So
yeah, that happened last year, right, Tom?
It did. Yeah, and it was just it was an awful story. And as I said, a bit of closure for the family and for the rest of us who mourn.
And for people to take seriously, they smell gas in the house, get the utility company there. That's
correct.
What this turned out to be all about. Pat, how about you? Local stories?
We had a bit of a jaw-dropping court case here this week. A foster mom on trial for duct taping two children, wrapping them in duct tape like mummies, and she was found not guilty, even though in court she admitted to securing their diapers and pajamas with duct tape. The jury just wasn't convinced that she hadn't been set up by her husband.
You know, in all seriousness, this may be exactly why we need gossip, because it's light and frivolous, and there's so much dark stuff out there. But, Tom, just to really finish up, a lighter story?
Well, we did have a lighter story, that's for sure. It was the buzz of the newsroom. We first had a report in the small town of Millville. There was an alligator in someone's home. As it turns out, when wildlife officials got there and our own photographer got there, turns out there were two alligators. One of them was 6 foot long, and the other just a little baby at 2 feet.
Wow.
But in the meantime, I've heard this whole reptile business is a $5 billion business here in the United States.
Billion with a B?
With a B. Fascinating and rather bizarre stuff.
Fascinating and bizarre. From Great Britain to Framingham, Massachusetts, Tom Maroney, columnist for the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
And Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Thanks, Pat.
You're welcome.
Still to come, Russell Crowe takes to the high seas in the new film Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. We'll have a review.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Wheaton College in Illinois has lifted its ban on dancing. The only dance partners that students at Wheaton were allowed to have were their relatives at family events. Tonight, for the first time in the school's 143-year history, up to 1,200 students will gather in the school's gym for the first real co-ed dance. Heidi is a junior at Wheaton, and she joins us on the line. Hi.
Hi.
Well, now, are you excited?
Yes, I'm excited.
Well, explain to us, I know there are a lot of Protestant sects that do not allow dancing. Is that behind the rule at Wheaton College?
I think it used to be.
In fact, students were barred from dancing unless it was with members of the same sex or square dancing, right?
Yes, that's right.
Did you ever question that when you came to school?
Well, I figured it was only 4 years, so I could take it.
Do you ever, like, sneak off somewhere to dance, or should we not talk about that?
I haven't, but some of my friends have.
Oh, boy. Was that sort of considered sinful? What would be thought of someone who would dance?
Oh, it just wasn't following the rules.
I know.
But I'm sure that happens at a lot of colleges.
Well, but very different kinds of rules. We hear from alumni who went to Wheaton who've been calling us that they're so excited about this, but it's such a great school that they didn't really mind.
Yeah, it's not that big a deal.
Well, now, we hear that students have been getting dance lessons for tonight because they didn't know how to dance. Is that true?
Yes.
What kind of lessons? What's been happening?
Well, the lessons have been so full that my date didn't get a chance to sign up, so I didn't actually go.
Oh, but what did you hear happen?
Oh, well, it was pretty typical. The kids just went and practiced dancing. A lot of them hadn't danced before, so it took them a little while to learn. And swing dancing is a little more complicated than...
Oh, so it's going to be swing dancing?
Yes.
I wondered, the swim... the Boogaloo. You know, there's a lot that you have to catch up on.
Oh, well, actually, I'm from a public school, so I've danced before.
You have danced before, so you can help your date. What is everyone saying about this? I mean, 1,200 students attending, this is sounds like it's a big deal.
Yes, people have been talking about it.
And we understand that this is a new set of rules that covers a lot of different things. For instance, there was a ban on alcohol and smoking for faculty and staff, and that's been eased.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the dance ban has been lifted. It's called a community covenant, and it said that students may dance, but you must avoid behavior which may be immodest, sinfully erotic, or harmfully violent.
Yes, I'm not sure the difference between sinfully erotic and, righteously erotic. It's a little strange.
Well, and certainly you don't want to hurt anybody when you go out and take the violence out of the two-step. That's, of course, a good thing. Well, have you seen the movie Footloose? Have you ever seen that?
No, I didn't.
Apparently, Footloose is, you know, it's about a school or a high school, actually, that banned dancing because of, again, a Protestant sect that does ban dancing. And the kids kind of went crazy. What do you expect is going to happen tonight?
I think it'll be pretty quiet.
And I hear you're going to be dancing to such tunes as Sentimental Journey and Sunny Side of the Street.
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, you just go shake your booty anyway.
I will.
Heidi, thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Heidi is a junior at Wheaton College in Illinois. They'll be holding their first dance in 143 years tonight. Now I gotta cut loose, pull loose. Kicked off the Sunday shoes. Please,
Louise, pull me up from my knees. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Men in search of the fountain of youth no one's yet managed to tap into have in recent years been trying testosterone replacement therapy. But is it doing anything to really face down time? Joining us on the line from Duke University's Medical Center is Dr. Dan Blazer, who led a study into testosterone replacement therapy. Welcome, doctor.
Good to be here.
Doctor, why are men doing testosterone replacement therapy?
I think one reason that older men are taking testosterone is they really are looking for an anti-aging drug. This looks like a potential possibility, given the fact that some preliminary anecdotal evidence suggests that this particular drug might do the very things that men are having concern about, such as improve their sexual functioning, increase their vitality, improve their cognitive functioning, improve their strength, decrease their weight, and we could go on and on.
So, doctor, does it work?
I think the bottom line of the report that we wrote was that we just don't know.
Mm.
There is no compelling evidence to suggest that testosterone replacement therapy can eliminate or retard the effects of aging and specific symptoms, and we don't know that there are specific dangers. We just don't have the evidence to date.
Now, tens of thousands of men are apparently doing this. How large was your study, and why is it still rather inconclusive?
Our study was basically a review of the existing studies. What we found was, given the low numbers of studies that we consider to be providing decent evidence for whether testosterone replacement therapy could be of benefit or not, coupled with the mixed results, we felt that no evidence really existed yet to provide a strong indication for using the medication, nor did we find that there was strong evidence to suggest that the medication should not be used.
Hmm. Any wariness, though, given the experience of women who were urged to use hormone replacement therapy in many cases, and then only found out later that it was causing serious illness?
You must remember that early on, there was a true belief with hormone replacement therapy in females that drugs really did have some benefit, even though it was actually known at the time that there might be some detriments to the drug, such as cancer. With testosterone replacement therapy, we don't even have the data regarding what the true benefits might be. There are some anecdotal suggestions, and there have been some hints in some of the studies that we reviewed that the drugs might be of some benefit, but we just don't have that evidence yet. We think that caution very much is in order given the increasing number of prescriptions that are being written and given the rush of, I think, many older persons or people in midlife as well to try to stave off the effects of aging.
If a patient of yours came into your office and said, "Doctor, I just can't take it. I want to try something. I just don't want to get old. I want to take testosterone," what would you say?
I personally would not prescribe the drug to the individual. The drug itself is only approved FDA-wise for those individuals who have hypogonadism, which is basically a low testosterone level accompanied by other symptoms. And that would probably not describe many of the individuals who would come into your office and just say, "I'm trying to get out of the difficulties I'm experiencing with aging." We just don't have the evidence to suggest that it's beneficial, and we just don't know about the risk in the long run.
Dr. Dan Blaser joined us from Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. Thanks very much, Doctor.
Listen, you're welcome.
Well, looking for a testosterone-infused movie? Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, opens today. Budgeted at $135 million and directed by Peter Weir, Master and Commander is set during the Napoleonic War and stars Russell Crowe as English Captain Jack Aubrey, who battles the French on the open sea. Just sitting through the preview trailer took the breath away.
Just a broken arms.
You're in very good hands. 7 weeks sailing, and he happened on our exact position.
Well, then perhaps he was looking for us.
Damn, he was good.
With basic repairs, we can get home as we are.
We're not going home.
Our enemy has
more than twice our guns,
more than twice our numbers,
and we are supposed to stop it.
Here now, film critic Eric Schaefer joins us in the studio to spin us his seafaring yarn about Master and Commander. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
I only saw, what did I say, a minute of this. I looked over at my mother. It was just a preview, mm-hmm. and I think her hair was blown back. It seemed extraordinary. Your thoughts?
It's a pretty rousing trailer, and it's an even more rousing movie. This is a crackerjack piece of old-fashioned entertainment.
Oh, good, good. Tell us more about it.
Some people may know that this film is based on a series of novels written by Patrick O'Brien, these very popular novels about Lucky Jack Aubrey. Takes place in 1805. The wars are raging in Europe, but the HMS Surprise, which Aubrey is commanding, is off the coast of Brazil, and he's been directed to track down this French privateer, this super frigate called the Acheron. But they soon find that they're the ones who are being chased on Surprise, and so we have this cat and mouse game. There are also a couple of subplots. There's this whole episode where they sweep around Cape Horn and back in this terrible storm. And then, of course, we also have lots of God and country and speechifying as well.
England is under threat of invasion. And though we be on the far side of the world, this ship is our home. This ship is England. So it's every hand to his rope or gun, quick's the word and sharp's the action. After all, Surprise is on our side.
Eric, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. As I said, it cost $135 million. Do you see that on the screen, as they say?
Yeah, I think you really do, because they have really gone to extraordinary lengths to make this film seem realistic, to seem true to the period. And that's really, in some ways, the best thing about this movie, because you really do get the sense of what it was like to have lived and worked on board one of these vessels in the early 19th century.
Well, the film revolves around Russell Crowe's character. Russell Crowe, of course, several-time Academy Award nominee, and he won for Gladiator. Does he hold the center well?
Yes. You know, I have more and more respect for Russell Crowe each time I see him on screen. And, you know, he brings to this role of Jack Aubrey the right combination of swagger and ego, tempered by a little self-doubt. He has some humor. And it's really hard to imagine any other contemporary star in this role.
And, of course, he works with a cast. I just want to pick out one scene because I saw something in the preview. There's a small boy on this ship. Tell me he ends up okay, or maybe you can't tell us what happens.
Well, I don't want to spoil the suspense, but yeah, there's this kid named Max Perkis who plays Midshipman Blankney. He just brings a real humanity, a great sense of sort of wonder and awe to the role, and it's a great sort of relationship that's built between him and Aubrey.
Excuse me, sir.
Move your hat, Blakeney.
May I speak with you, sir?
Yes, yes.
Mr. Callamy says I'm not on the boarding party. I wanted to say that.
I know what you want to say. My answer is no. You'll lead your gun crew, and then when we board, you'll take command of the ship from here on the quarterdeck. Do I make myself clear?
Take command of the ship. Thank you, sir.
Back to your station.
Another scene from Master and Commander, which brings to mind the question, you know, the film is rated PG-13, and I know that sailor films are, that's big now, Pirates of the Caribbean, mm-hmm. you know, did really well, and there are many more of these sort of, you know, extravaganzas coming out. But should children see this?
You know, I think that kids probably 10, 12 and up could see this. The film is bookended by two pretty horrific battle scenes, sea battles between the Acheron and the Surprise. And there are also a couple of pretty tough scenes of shipboard surgery as well.
Okay.
It's all kind of below the frame and stuff, but they're very intensely shot. But I think that kids will probably be fairly caught up in this film.
Okay, so one has to decide if the kids should go, but you're saying everybody else, run, don't walk.
Or swim. I think, you know, I was really pleasantly surprised. They've really done an excellent job in kind of cutting to the chase in this film. It really reminds me a lot of the old 30s movies like The Seahawk and Captain Blood and things like that. It really is good old-fashioned entertainment, and I think that it's going to be one of those things that families can see after a little bit of consideration for the kids.
Here now, film reviewer Eric Schaefer, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
His review of Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. It opens in theaters today.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
President Bush goes to London. Will he be allowed to see the thousands of protesters who are promising to greet him?
And jazz bassists with our jazz man, James Isaacs.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.